case for argument this morning is Freedom Mortgage against Burnham Mortgage.
Good morning, and may it please.
Mr. Dressler.
Dennis Dressler on behalf of the appellant, Freedom Mortgage Corporation. I ask to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. We ask this court to reverse the granting of summary judgment entered by the trial court for the reasons set forth in our brief. This morning, I'd like to address three additional arguments in support of our position. The remaining arguments will be supported by our brief. Those three arguments all deal with the damages that Freedom is seeking and the legal basis for recovering those damages. The first category of damages are the tort damages. Freedom was required, as a result of the tortious conduct of the defendants, to repurchase 9 obligations totaling over $2.2 million. Now, the defendants would have some right to set off that amount, but that amount of the set off has never been determined. The second category of damages are the deficiency damages that were determined in the Illinois foreclosure courts. Those damages exceed $589,000. The third category of damages are the contract damages against Defendant Tycor under the closing protection letter, which we've called the CPL throughout the briefing, and against Burnham under the Burnham Agreement. Under the CPL, Tycor agreed to reimburse Freedom for all actual losses in connection with the negligence of its agents. And under the Burnham Agreement, Burnham agreed to reimburse Freedom for all damages as a result, including the repurchase demands. Now, this case is before this court following the initial summary judgment on the issue of the credit bid by Judge Phillip in Freedom 1, which addressed 6 of the 9 properties. In Freedom 2, the district court fundamentally misunderstood the opinion of Freedom 1 and misapplied the credit bid rule as it is allowed under the under Illinois law. In Freedom 1, Judge Phillip recognized that...
I don't know what difference it makes whether the second district judge correctly understood the first district judge. The question is whether the second district judge is correct. Now, the underlying question here is the preclusive effect of a state judgment, and we have to give it the effect that a state court would give it. So the initial question for us is, what would happen if this suit had been filed in state court? Have the Illinois courts discussed the preclusive effect of the monetary award in a foreclosure action?
They have with respect to mortgagors and mortgagees, in that the longstanding rule on the credit bid is that the value of the property...
Yeah, I know what the effect is. Everybody knows what the effect is with respect to the borrower. Mm-hmm. Right? I was interested in, have the state courts discussed the preclusive effect with respect to title insurance companies, mortgage brokers, other intermediaries?
Only tangentially. Judge Phillip recognized that this was an issue of...
Tell me anything about Judge Phillip. I'm asking about state courts.
No. This is an issue of first impression under Illinois law.
Are there any Illinois procedural rules that affect this question? I mean, suppose Freedom had filed the state foreclosure action and named Burnham Mortgage or Tycor Title as a party and sought relief against them in addition to the foreclosure of the loan in a consolidated action. Would that have been permissible under state law?
It's my understanding it would have. There's nothing that would have precluded.
So then the question is, what does state law, how does Illinois understand the preclusive effect, if any, of failure to join a party?
There's two doctrines that are interrelated in this, necessary party and res judicata. Under Illinois' Mortgage Foreclosure Act, Tycor, Burnham, and the rest of the tort defendants were not necessary parties to the foreclosure actions. Under Illinois law, the LP 26 as well as the House School of Finance decisions, that a mortgage fraud case, you can sue to foreclose out your mortgage lien and adjudicate your deficiency judgment in state court, and you can sue a separate, distinct, and concurrent action for damages incurred as a mortgage fraud. citing LP 26, Household Finance, and Federal Savings.
When I asked my question the first time, you said there's no Illinois law on the preclusive effect of the foreclosure. You now tell me that Illinois specifically allows a separate suit for fraud against people like Burnham. And that suggests they've held that there is not preclusion, because otherwise you couldn't have a separate suit. So where is this specific authorization? Because it sounds like that resolves the preclusion issue.
Perhaps I didn't understand the question before.
Could you raise your voice, please?
I didn't understand the question before. The response to your question, as I understood it, is there any bar to Freedom instituting separate and concurrent actions to foreclose its mortgage lien and obtain a deficiency judgment in state court and maintain a separate action to recover damages as a result of the tortious conduct of the defendant? And the answer is no. There is no preclusive law in Illinois that limits Freedom from doing that. And in fact, LP 26, dealing with a guarantee contract, said expressly that you can maintain two separate actions.
You're talking in code. What LP 26?
I'm sorry, LP 26 versus Goldstein. It's a decision that was relied upon in the district court and which has been cited in the appellate briefs. So there's three categories of damages that Freedom is seeking in this proceeding. One is the tort damages. One is the deficiency judgments. And the last is the contract claims. Talk about the tort damages. As indicated previously, Freedom was required to pay $2.2 million to repurchase nine of these obligations from its lender, DLJ. As the Alliance Court, the Supreme Court in California, in the Alliance decision, when it was confronted with this similar and almost exact factual circumstance, it said that, of course, there's no bar to the lender being able to recover for those repurchase amounts against folks who have tortiously acted against it. The track mortgage case cited in the district court and cited extensively on appeal also concurs with that there is no bar to pursuing not only the mortgagors to foreclose out the lien and attain deficiency judgment in the foreclosure proceeding, but obtaining relief against the tort defendants for the tort causes of action. And in particular, the Alliance Mortgage decision says that the amounts that the lender had to repay to repurchase the loan obligations were a direct consequence of the fraud. Moving on to the deficiency judgments. The Illinois foreclosure courts entered nine foreclosure orders, what we've been calling the final orders. And each and every one of those final orders were entered after the district court proceedings had commenced. Each of those final orders granted Freedom a deficiency judgment. Each of those final orders said that Freedom could not pursue the mortgagor defendants for the deficiency, but they did not say that Freedom could not pursue other defendants under other theories of causes of action to obtain those damages. Now, the defendants have claimed that because Freedom waived the recovery as to the mortgagor defendants for the deficiencies, that waiver somehow transfers to them. In our briefing, we've addressed that for a waiver to be applied in this circumstance, there must be a knowing and voluntary relinquishment of a known right. This is not a case where there's a settlement.
Constitutional case where a criminal defendant is waiving his right to counsel. It's perfectly normal civil litigation. Now, if I understand Tycor's position correctly, Tycor contends that this waiver impaired its right of subrogation under the contract, and therefore Tycor says it's entitled to win. Isn't that a perfectly straightforward argument?
It would be, except for the language of the guarantee of the CPL. Unlike
Could you tell me what you mean? Your acronyms may be well known to you, but they're not known to normal generalists.
Appendix B. And the exclusion C, what Tycor's agreement says is that we will not reimburse you to the extent that you have impaired the subrogation interest. To the extent, it's not by the choosing of their own language, they have chosen the extent of the coverage that they will afford. And it's not an automatic. If you impair our subrogation interest, then we don't owe you anything. They could have written that, but they did not, and they're bound by the language that they used. They said, to the extent that your subrogation interest is impaired, essentially a dollar-for-dollar reduction in what we have to pay you. That necessarily involves a factual determination. To the extent, Freedom has alleged throughout these entire proceedings that some of the mortgagor defendants were fictitious persons. So to the extent that you waived a judgment against a fictitious person, what extent have you impaired their subrogation interest? Secondly, there's 19 other defendants in the case.
Wiped out the subrogation interest when you release the obligor. There just isn't anything left.
You still don't get there, though, because the language of the agreement with Tycor, the consumer protection letter, says it's going to reimburse Freedom for all actual losses in connection with the tortious conduct and negligence of its agents. That is not, by the language used, the substantial or the exact equivalent of the amounts due and owing under the promissory note. If Tycor wanted the amounts due and owing, if Tycor wanted to limit exposure to simply the amounts due and owing under the promissory note, they knew exactly how to do that. Judge Posner in the Tara Corp decision made it abundantly clear in an indemnity-indemnitor relationship that the contracting parties are bound by the language that they use. Throughout the briefing, Tycor has argued that its exposure in this case is just simply limited to the amounts due and owing on the promissory note. Well, if that's the case, why didn't they say that? They agreed to indemnify Freedom for amounts due and owing as a result of the negligence, a tort. It's not the same contractual, it's not the same damages as a contract, the promissory note between the mortgagor and the mortgagee. So even if the court does find a waiver, which we don't think exists, but it doesn't get Exeter and Halava off the hook, because they're still liable for tort damages. The tort damages are separate and distinct from the deficiency judgments. It doesn't get Burnham off the hook, because Burnham is, under its contract, is liable for the amounts that Freedom had to repurchase the 9 obligations from DLJ. And it doesn't get Tycor off the hook, because Tycor's liability and is not limited solely to the promissory notes. Its actual losses in connection with the negligence of its agents, which as a matter of law cannot just be the amounts due and owing under the promissory notes. I want to speak briefly about the Rooker-Feldman that was brought up by the appellees. Rooker-Feldman just simply does not apply in this context. Judge Ginsburg made it clear in the Exxon versus Saudi decision that where you have...
Counsel, this is the second time you have given the name of a judge as if that mattered to the decision. Decisions of the court are decisions of the court. They're not decisions of particular judges.
Thank you. I'll refrain from doing that going forward. In the ExxonMobil...
Dissents, however, are unique. They're applied only to the individual judge.
This was not a dissent. The Rooker-Feldman Doctrine, it does not apply in this case. I notice I have one more minute, but just very quickly, the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine does not apply in this case. These were concurrent lawsuits. The Supreme Court in Exxon versus Saudi makes clear that when you have concurrent lawsuits, that the Rieger-Feldman doctrine is not applicable. Moreover, we're not trying to have the district court review the state court judgments. What we're trying to do is adjudicate separate and distinct causes of action against these defendants. I reserve my time.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Gimbel.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Barbara Anderson Gimbel. I represent Tycor Title Insurance Company. I'd like to discuss with your honors the concepts of finality under varying doctrines. The first concept is under the Illinois mortgage foreclosure laws and the concept of satisfaction and waiver. On this principle alone, this court may affirm the district court. Counsel indicated to your honors that there is no guiding precedent in terms of the preclusive effect of the foreclosure action on this court, and that there's nothing comparable to the situation faced by Tycor. That is not accurate. I agree that this is a first impression case to the extent that the underlying transaction involves mortgage fraud. However, this is certainly not a case of first impression where a court was asked to review losses and the impact on insurers and indemnitors in the context of the mortgage foreclosure proceedings. We have seen that in the Western Employers decision. We've seen it in Partell. And both of those cases rely on the New York decision of Whitestone. In relying on Whitestone, the court...
Excuse me. I had thought it was a given in this case that if... I mean, suppose Jones borrows money from Freedom, and Smith guarantees Jones's obligation. Freedom then files a foreclosure action against Jones. I thought it was given that Freedom could later sue the guarantor separately. Was that not given in Illinois law?
You are correct, Your Honor, okay. To a certain extent.
But does it not follow from that that the state law of preclusion does not wipe out actions against people who are permissive but not mandatory parties in the initial action?
Does not necessarily follow, Your Honor, because you're correct that Illinois would allow that as a permissive party.
You can
party.
Sue a guarantor separately. Why can't you sue an insurer separately? They're fundamentally the same thing.
Depends on the language of the contract that is the subject.
The law of preclusion can't depend on the language of the contract.
Well, the law of preclusion would certainly bar the borrower. That is a given here. I believe that's not contested. We have full credit bids and full waivers on all of the properties. The question is then, what impact does it have on an indemnitor? And we have to look at the contract language because we deal with the privity situation and the obligations and our contractual obligations and whether that we can also claim the bar that the party imposed upon themselves. So in looking at our indemnity obligation, we only agree, Tycor, for the actual losses that are sustained. By virtue of the full credit bid and the partial credit bids with waiver of deficiencies, there are no damages, and as Your Honor pointed out, there is simply nothing left to indemnify. If the case is relied upon...
I'm totally lost.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's assume, if I understand this lawsuit correctly, one of the theories in the suit rests on RICO, that there's some kind of organized criminal conspiracy here, and RICO allows damages multipliers. So the state court, applying the credit bid rule, certainly establishes the amount of damages, but what is it about the state law of preclusion that prevents an award of double damages if the defendants are all in some giant criminal conspiracy?
Well, Your Honor, you are now turning to the second point, which is the res judicata concept. Let me just be clear.
That's what I
yes,
thought
Honor.
We have been talking about all along. That's at least what I've been trying to ask about.
Yes, Your Honor. I just wanted to be clear that there are two different concepts that this court could affirm upon. You can affirm upon the mortgage foreclosure laws itself, and there are the case laws, the Partell decision and the Western Employers decision and the Chrysler decision. You don't even need to get into res judicata analysis. But getting into the res judicata analysis, which is what Your Honor is alluding to, Illinois law just as this court applies the and Illinois law governs here, the transactional test. Counsel would have you believe that the same evidence test or the primary rights test apply. And how would he have you believe that? By his reliance on the alliance decision in his argument you just heard and the track decision. Those cases are California cases that relies on the primary rights doctrine analysis of res judicata. Likewise, the same evidence theory has been rejected by the River Parks and the Rain decision. It has no application here. The question is, do they arise from the same transaction? You can spin it any different theory way you wise, Your Honor.
Maybe there's something here I am not appreciating, but the reason I started this by asking how Illinois treats suits against guarantors is that the suit against a guarantor arises out of the very same transaction, that is, the borrowing of money and the failure to repay. So if Illinois allows a separate action against a guarantor, that must establish the principle that there is no mandatory joinder in the initial action. And if there's no mandatory joinder, I can't see why actions under a completely different statute that allow for doubling or trebling of damages are wiped out. Now, maybe there's something weird about Illinois law that I'm missing, but I'd like you to explain how your position can be reconciled with the fact that everybody agrees that Illinois allows a separate suit against a guarantor.
The guarantor language in those cases relied upon by counsel look specifically at the language of the guarantee. And they say, and they exclude out, notwithstanding your conduct at foreclosure sales, we will still remain liable under the promissory note. Very explicit in those cases. The only case that is not explicit is the Emerson case, which has no discussion whatsoever, in it, but it was a pre-amendment to the Illinois Mortgage Foreclosure Act. So that being said,
let me state what I understand you to be saying in my terms. I understand you to be saying that state law, in fact, provides for preclusion, for claim preclusion against guarantors, but that those cases were decided as they were because the guarantors had signed an anticipatory waiver of the right to plead claim preclusion.
That's correct.
Is that what the state courts say? Is that the state judge's rationale?
They specifically look at the language of these guarantees. Yes, they do. I mean, they don't say it because they weren't asked to contemplate what is before Your Honors and what is before them. However, it's very clear that they looked at that contract language and saw that they did not agree to be subject. They agreed to not be subject to any waiver of deficiency. We have never, as indemnitors, waived our rights to take the claims and defenses and bar freedom from their conduct. They had an obligation as the indemnity to control the proceeding to preserve their rights against us. They did not. They knowingly, this case was pending when they went and made their bids. They knowingly went into these auctions and they either bid their full credit bid or they waived deficiencies on all nine actions. If they wanted to preserve their indemnity rights, they should have bid appropriately. They are treated under Illinois law as strangers to the bidding process. They have an obligation to bid a fair amount because that will be held against them subsequent to the litigation. And they cannot now claim that they were somehow not to be barred by their conduct because they needed to know what they were doing going into the bidding process. And even the record supports the fact that they knew very clearly that they had a mortgage fraud situation on their hands and that they nevertheless bid as they did. And I should point out to this court that the Chrysler decision is very helpful in terms of giving guidance into why this case, the mortgage fraud is a red herring, why this court should nevertheless be affirmed. Because basically they're saying in the Chrysler decision that unless the mortgage...
The Chrysler decision is not only a federal decision. They too, are playing the role of ventriloquist dummy, but they're trying to channel Michigan law. And I've been trying to focus people on Illinois law, which may or may not be Michigan law, and may or may not have been correctly understood by the Second Circuit. That's why I want people to talk about Illinois cases.
Right. And the reason why I bring it up, Your Honor, and I appreciate that, and if you see in the brief, it's certainly persuasive because they rely, just as the Illinois courts relied in the Western Employers decision and the Partell decision, in terms of evaluating loss and its impact on indemnitors in a fire damage situation. In the Chrysler decision, they also relied on Whitestone. So what I'm trying to convey to Your Honor is the same logic that follows in this directly analogous situation in Michigan, the same case precedent supports our decisions in Illinois under the loss and the indemnity obligations that were due and owing. I'm not sure if that was clear, but if you look to the precedent cited within, Whitestone is relied both by the Michigan, under Michigan law, and under Illinois law. So I'm basically saying that there's no true distinction as to why this court should not apply the Partell and the Western Employers decision to this type of situation. I think they're dead on point. And finally, in terms of our discussion about collateral estoppel, I believe here that this issue, again, about the deficiency was very clearly adjudicated. There are no damages. There's no reason to undermine their admissions of damages. And like the concept of res judicata, the doctrine of collateral estoppel should likewise bar. Finally, on the Rooker-Feldman, if you are going to challenge, as Freedom is trying to do here, that a state court judgment is void, you are certainly attacking that judgment, and this court lacks jurisdiction to do that. It's clearly Rooker-Feldman, and the district court recognized that, and notably, it was not raised until the reply brief to this court until we pointed that fact to this court. Thank you very much for your time. In sum, we believe that you can look at the concept of satisfaction under the mortgage foreclosure laws, as well as the concepts of res judicata, collateral estoppel, and Rooker-Feldman to support and affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ball.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is David Ball. I represent the appellee, John Jeffrey Halava. I'm not going to try to be repetitive. I'm going to be very, very short. Mr. Halava was the attorney that represented the sellers in connection with the transactions of the nine properties or some of the nine properties at issue in this case. He had no relationship with the plaintiff appellant, was not retained as their counsel, had no relationship or no privity of contract, and owed no duties or responsibilities to the plaintiff. The plaintiff has talked about three different types of damages that they seek to recover in the underlying action. And the district court was correct in their decisions to grant summary judgment to the defendants in dismissing these cases. Number one, they talked about tort damages. The claim for tort damages was properly dismissed by the court on the grounds that the credit alliance or the full credit bid was applicable and eliminated any deficiency under the notes. Without being able to establish any deficiency in the notes, there are no tort damages. The state court proceedings each
perplexed, counsel. You say without being able to establish any deficiency, but the state court judgments established that there were deficiencies.
But Your Honor, the state court judgments in each of the properties, in connection with the sale of each of the properties, the plaintiff in those cases waived any claim for deficiency. And therefore, there is no actionable.
Freedom did not waive a claim for a deficiency. Freedom waived its argument to collect the deficiency judgment. But in fact, the state courts entered deficiency judgments. Now, one might think that a promise not to collect a judgment from Smith does not mean that the judgment can't be collected from Jones. Go back to my guarantee hypothetical, right?
Yes.
Green guarantees Jones's mortgage, and there's a deficiency judgment and a promise not to collect from one of these people. Does that bar, as a matter of Illinois law, does that bar collection from the other as well?
I think, Your Honor, on...
I'm not asking what you think. I'm asking about Illinois law.
I do not... Illinois law, I believe, would not preclude that claim under certain circumstances.
So there was a deficiency judgment, and the only question here is who is liable for it, and are multipliers under federal law permissible?
Or whether the deficiency has been waived.
No,
or whether there's any collateral estoppel.
We're back where we started.
Yes.
Deficiency has not been waived. There was a deficiency judgment actually entered by the state court. There was also a promise not to collect it from the borrower. That doesn't mean there's no deficiency judgment. You've already told me that with respect to a claim against a guarantor.
Yes. The third category of damages that they seek to collect, Your Honor, are the contract damages, which they've characterized as contract damages. Those claims, if there are any contract damages, arise in connection with contracts or agreements to which Mr. Halava was not party to. There is no claim against Mr. Halava for contract damages. So the only possible claim that could have been asserted against Mr. Halava in connection with the underlying actions would be the claims for tort damages or for a deficiency judgment. And, Your Honor, it is our position that the district courts were correct in applying both their analysis of the credit bid rule as outlined by the California courts, not being able to find Illinois precedent, but as in relying upon their interpretation of the California holdings of both the Alliance case and the Track Mortgage case, that in this under the facts and circumstances of this situation or these cases, that those claims have been precluded and summary judgment was appropriate. I don't really have anything else to add as to the claims other than what's set forth in the brief and what's been previously argued by other counsel, so I don't want to be repetitive. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Ball. Anything further, Mr. Pressler?
I'd like to just briefly address the application of the Western Employers versus Ravenswood case mentioned by counsel for Tycor, as well as the Partell versus Harris Trust and the Whitestone Savings and Loan Association cases and the Track Mortgage cases. Those are the decisions that counsel for Tycor said gives this court authority to affirm the granting of summary judgment. One thing that's important for the court to recognize is that those cases dealt with situations involving coverage for fire insurance. As the Whitestone decision makes clear, that the coverage afforded to the insured under a fire case is the value of the property. And those are full credit bid cases. So when you have a full credit bid, there's nothing left to insure because the full credit bid conclusively establishes the value of the property. Contrast that with the contract and then the insurance in the present case. They're not fire insurance coverage. Tycor, under the consumer protection letter, said it would reimburse Freedom for all losses incurred as the negligence of its agents, far different than a fire insurance. The Burnham Agreement says that it's going to reimburse Freedom from all claims that it had to pay out to repurchase the loan obligations from its lender. Again, very different from the fire insurance cases cited by Tycor. It's also important to note that the coverage under the consumer protection letter was denied prior to the entry of each and every one of the final orders. So there was no privity of interest for res judicata to apply. Any privity between Tycor and Freedom under the consumer protection letter was destroyed by an intervening event, and that intervening event was the denial of the insurance coverage. In fact, there was no unity of interest, and that is demonstrated by the fact that Freedom sued Tycor prior to the entry of each and every one of the final orders for coverage under the CPL. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.